I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The turnout for this past spring's primary in Pennsylvania was the highest in something like 25 years. Democrats were more likely to mail in their ballots, while Republicans were more likely to vote in person. The state Supreme Court ruled this week that Act 77, the mail-in voting law that was passed by the Republican-controlled legislature in 2019, was constitutional. This was after Commonwealth Court struck down the law earlier this year. The fight over the 2020 presidential election in Pennsylvania continues to reverberate today, involving a scheme using fake electors and a candidate for governor, Republican Doug Mastriano, who attended the Stop the Steal rally on January 6th and is an ardent election denier. His opponent is Democrat Josh Shapiro, the Commonwealth's Attorney General. The race to fill retiring Senator Pat Toomey's seat is getting national attention, with Lieutenant Governor Democrat John Fetterman relentlessly trolling celebrity doctor Republican Mehmet Oz for being a carpetbagger. Now, Fetterman had a stroke just before the primary and is still recovering. His first public event since the stroke is set for next Friday in Erie. A new Fox poll puts both Democrats about 10 points ahead. Well, we have a lot to discuss, and we've got three guests who have joined us. Stephen Medvick is director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs, co-director of the Floyd Institute for Public Policy, also professor of government at Franklin and Marshall College. Stephen Medvick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be with you.
Also with us and joining us by Skype is Jonathan Tamari. He is national political reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jonathan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests, Holly Otterbein, national political reporter at Politico. She covers Pennsylvania. And Holly, it's good to have you with us as well.
Great to be here, Marty.
And to our listeners, we want to hear from you, especially those of you who live in Pennsylvania or maybe New Jersey. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stephen, let me begin with you just with a kind of broad-based question. But in my introduction, I included several things that are going on here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. It seems like a really revved up election season this year. Is that what you see?
I do. I think it's, you know, I think politics now is revved up all throughout the nation. But Pennsylvania is really going to be the focus of the nation's attention this fall, because both for the Senate race and the gubernatorial race, there's just so much going on in the state, and it's such an important battleground state that it does feel supercharged this year.
And do you feel that way as well, Jonathan, as someone who's covering the state and these elections?
Absolutely. I mean, governor's races are always significant, but then you add in the layer of the end of Roe v. Wade and the fact that the next governor could either sign or veto new abortion restrictions, that the next governor and their secretary of state will oversee the 2024 presidential election. You have a 50-50 Senate, and you know, one of the key races is in Pennsylvania that could decide who controls that Senate. So these races are always important, but the stakes are even higher this year than usual.
Does that make it more interesting, Holly, to cover Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I mean, I think that these are the most interesting races in the country, honestly, and it is absolutely amped up in a way that I don't think I've seen before. I mean, in the primary, we had like presidential election level spending, for instance, on the GOP side in the Senate primary, because you had two self-funders just throwing, you know, as much money as they could at each other. You've got a celebrity in Mehmet Oz running for the Senate. You've got John Fetterman, you know, who's a kind of mini celebrity in his own right, very like unusual candidate. Then you've got, you know, Doug Mastriano and Josh Shapiro, who couldn't be more different. So it's been very interesting to cover.
Well, let me just ask a question or two about what this state Supreme Court did this week, essentially upholding Act 77. Again, as I mentioned in my introduction, passed by the Republican-controlled legislature, that Pennsylvania voters can vote by mail, that they do not need an excuse to do that. Stephen, were you surprised at all by what the Supreme Court did? Do we have Stephen?
No, I wasn't. I mean, the yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I'm not sure he can hear me. Let's see if we can figure that out. Let me put that to you, Jonathan Tamari. Was that a surprising decision from your perspective?
It wasn't surprising. It's a Supreme Court that's controlled by Democrats, by Democratic judges. And so I don't think it was surprising, but you never know when there's a court case exactly how judges are going to come down. You can't always predict, but I think most people assumed that they would uphold this law, and it ends up being a potentially significant thing in that, you know, not long ago, mail voting was not really seen as a partisan thing, but it has become a partisan thing since it's been attacked by former President Donald Trump. It's now much more used by Democrats, and it looks like that method's going to continue to be available in this election and in the presidential election in 2 years.
Well, even going back a couple of years, and I'll put this back to you, Jonathan Tamari, one of the glitches, it seems to be, that with these mail-in ballots, they cannot even be opened, or it seems like even touched, until election day. And as we learned 2 years ago with the presidential election, it took several days in order to get the final count in Pennsylvania, and that created a lot of confusion and chaos. Is that still the case?
That is still the case, and there are a number of advocates who think that that is something that needs to be changed so that the election results can come faster, so that it can increase confidence in the system. Now, to be clear, there's no evidence that anything went wrong in 2020. It just took a long time to work through the process because, as you point out, they couldn't even get started until Election Day. But it still kind of opens this time window for people to, for conspiracy theories to spread, for people to make accusations, even if they're baseless. And so there is a strong push to allow these votes to start being at least opening the envelopes, for example, because you've got mail-in votes have two envelopes. You need to open them both. You need to scan the ballots. It takes more time. To allow that to happen sooner, it's not clear if that's actually going to happen, though.
Let me go back to you, Holly, and even go back to Doug Mastriano. He's the Republican running for governor here in Pennsylvania. He did attend the Stop the Steal rally. I believe he went as far as the grounds of the U.S. Capitol. He is an election denier. What is his appeal to the Republicans?
I mean, I think you spelled it out in a lot of ways, right? You know, many Republican voters do not believe that the election in 2020 is legitimate. You know, there's no evidence that that's the case. But, you know, because of Donald Trump's lies, many of them believe that. And Doug Mastriano was really the face of the movement to overturn the election in Pennsylvania. You know, like you mentioned, he went to the Capitol on January 6th. He also, you know, did a number of things in terms of advocating for an audit of the election. He held a hearing, you know, where you know, many conspiracies were aired. He was also, according to a New York Times report, the point person for finding fake electors in Pennsylvania who would be willing to sign documentation. Now, we can get into it later, but the Republicans who were involved say that wasn't the case. But nonetheless, he was clearly very active in this push to overturn the election in Pennsylvania. And I think that, you know, really excited many Republican voters. It's not the only reason. He also was a very passionate advocate against coronavirus restrictions, regulations, you know, shutdowns of businesses, that sort of thing. And, you know, that also endeared him to a lot of the party base.
Well, let me get you back in on the conversation, Stephen Medvick. And I mean, primary voters, you know, tend to be more base type voters. A general election, you need to broaden your appeal. Do you think Mastriano can do that?
Well, whether he can or not, I'm not
or
sure.
Wants
he
to.
Doesn't, right. He doesn't seem to be attempting to do that. And it's really, to this point, it's pretty curious. Of course, he's not speaking to the mainstream media. And so that, you know, that cuts off an avenue of communication that he might have to swing voters. He's so far not advertising. He hasn't raised a lot of money. Now, outside groups will advertise sort of on his behalf, but he just doesn't seem to be attempting to communicate to the swing voter. And in a really competitive race like this gubernatorial race, you know, you need a kind of a mixture of both mobilizing your own supporters, but also persuading the handful of undecided sort of independent swing voters that might be out there. And there's just no sign that he's attempting to do that at this point.
And Jonathan, has the Republican Party in Pennsylvania or even the National Party, are they embracing Mastriano?
More and more so, they are. And that's a shift from the primary when a lot of them said, oh, he's too extreme to win. He'll not only will he lose, but he'll cost us other seats down ballot. There was a concerted effort at the last minute to really try to stop him from winning the nomination, but some of the very same people who were behind that effort are now actually rallying behind him and saying, well, you know, he's our nominee and he's better than Shapiro, so we're gonna go with him, despite some of their own past comments. So we are seeing much of the Republican establishment, I should say, come around to him.
Well, and it's pretty clear, at least for governor of Pennsylvania, if people are going to vote either Republican or Democrat, they have a pretty big choice. Jonathan, let me go back to you if I could. What is Shapiro's message to the Commonwealth?
His message is that he's going to stand up for democracy, that he's going to stand up for, you know, a faithful reading of the election results. And also now more recently, since the Roe v. Wade decision, that he will stop any new restrictions on abortion and that he will be kind of the firewall for Democrats between what's now a Republican held legislature and new restrictions on abortion, potentially new restrictions on voting, including mail voting or voter ID laws. And that Mastriano who's denying the election is too extreme to be trusted as the leader. Too extreme to be trusted to oversee the 2024 election when Donald Trump could be back on the ballot, and who we've seen is trying to install allies around the country who might be more compliant with his attempts to overturn an election if he was to run again and lose again.
And Holly, about a minute before our first break here, and it should be said here in Pennsylvania that the governor of Pennsylvania appoints the Secretary of State, and that is the person who oversees elections, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a, you know, huge deal, particularly right now in this environment. And, you know, we expect, of course, in 2024 for it to be again a close race in Pennsylvania. Doug Mastriano has not shared who he plans to appoint to Secretary of State if he were to win the election. Although he says he has somebody in mind, he hasn't announced that.
Has Shapiro said who he would appoint if he won?
Not as far as I know. There's obviously more questions, I think, about, you know, what Mastriano would do with the Secretary of State, just given that he, you know, is such a passionate election denier. And, you know, that raises questions about what he would do with that power.
And that is Holly Otterbein. She's national political reporter at Politico, covering Pennsylvania. Jonathan Tamari with us, national political reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Stephen Medvick, director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, giving us a bit of a preview for the race for the U.S. Senate and for the governorship here in Pennsylvania. We've got much more after this very short break, including abortion. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and we are talking about the fact that the political season here in Pennsylvania is gearing up. We're talking about some of the important races, one for the U.S. Senate, one for governor. We talked about the Supreme Court ruling on mail-in voting, the fake elector schemes, and there are many more issues at stake. And again, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Well, I do want to talk about abortion, and Stephen Medvick, I will start with you. It should be said that the KCV Planned Parenthood was a governor of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania. Let me just segue quickly to what happened in Kansas. A majority of the voters there, about 60% of them, essentially rejected a constitutional amendment in Kansas, which would have given the legislature the power to either ban or restrict abortion. There is a constitutional amendment that's going to make its way to voters here in Pennsylvania. What does that say, and what is the significance?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the surprise out of Kansas was just how big the vote was, how big the margin was in favor of protecting abortion rights. But polling suggests that a majority of voters in most states, not all states, but the vast majority of states, do want to keep abortion rights protected. And so it's not a surprise in that sense. But Kansas is a much more conservative state than Pennsylvania overall, and so the amendment that may come before voters as early as next spring, really probably has an uphill climb if Republicans in the General Assembly think that might pass. One thing I think that's important to keep in mind, though, a lot of people are wondering what it means for candidate races in the fall, and clearly in Kansas, some Republicans voted to protect abortion rights, but the evidence suggests that the real enthusiasm there and the big bump in turnout was among Democrats, and so that suggests that maybe Democrats will benefit from that issue in the fall. But I would caution that it's not an issue mm-hmm. vote like the vote in Kansas is very different than a candidate vote, and people consider all sorts of things for their candidate choices, and so. I don't think there's a one-to-one correspondence between what happened in Kansas and what might happen in candidate races in the fall.
And Jonathan, I mean, the language is different. It's a little bit on the vague side. The constitutional amendment would say there is no right to an abortion or abortion funding within Pennsylvania's constitution, which is different from the language that we saw in Kansas.
It would have a similar effect, I think, though. It would basically open the door where if the legislature was to pass new restrictions that go beyond where Pennsylvania's law currently stands, currently it's, I believe, legal up to 24 weeks, abortion is legal, right. It would open the door to that. And if somebody was to try to challenge that in court, they would say, well, listen, it's made clear that this is not a right under the Constitution. So it would basically provide a foundation for much more restrictive laws, which is very similar to what the AIM was in Kansas.
And from your perspective, Holly, has abortion now, since the U.S. Supreme Court decision, has this become a really defining and important political issue this campaign season?
I mean, it always was. We knew that this decision was going to come down this year. Then, even before the decision actually was released, it was leaked. And so we knew this was coming, and Josh Shapiro, the gubernatorial candidate, of course, made this an issue in his campaign, months ago, right? And it was a big issue, abortion, in the GOP primaries for governor and Senate as well, because everyone knew that this was going to happen. But the decision kind of exploded that and made it even bigger. And now, particularly in the governor's race, it's really key. That's because the legislature is controlled by Republicans. That's expected to stay the same. And so the governor is really going to have the power over, deciding whether or not abortion will remain legal in Pennsylvania. If it's Shapiro, he's promised to veto abortion restrictions. And Mastriano, on the other hand, is very anti-abortion. And so because of the stakes are so high and so clear, it has just become a gigantic issue. This is one of the, I think, clearest stakes across the country in the fall, is the Pennsylvania governor's race.
And that's fascinating. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Lindsay: there's never been a more important election in Pennsylvania. Abortion rights and even all the conspiracy theories about the 2020 election are, as she says, on the ballot. This needs to be a call for people to show up and vote for our future. An email from Becca: what's your opinion of the carpetbagger tweeting as referenced in the race for Senator Toomey's seat, the same name calling polling was done from the other side with Senator Clinton in New York. That gets us into this really interesting race between Mehmet Oz and John Fetterman. And Stephen Medvick, if I can go back to you, Fetterman has been trolling relentlessly, basically saying Oz is a carpetbagger. He doesn't live in Pennsylvania. He did misspell Huntingdon Valley, where he allegedly lives. But nonetheless, do you have to live in Pennsylvania to represent the voters?
Yes, you have to have residency in the state. And this issue of carpetbagging comes up every so often. And as the listener suggests, you know, the same issue was surrounded Hillary Clinton's run for the Senate. You know, I suspect that it's not an issue that in and of itself most voters will use to make a decision based upon. You know, it doesn't help a candidate who has those charges leveled against them, but I'm not sure it will move many voters unless you can convince the voters that, you know, being from out of the state suggests that you don't really understand their plight, that you don't really understand their needs, their interests. And so, I think Fetterman's having fun with this in the summer. We're sort of in the doldrums. There's not a lot going on. There's a little bit of advertising on Fetterman's behalf. But, you know, people are on vacation. People aren't paying close attention. So this is a way to garner some attention. And it's clever and it's entertaining. But I think at the end of the day, it probably won't be the issue around which people base their decision.
And Jonathan Tamari, meaning Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, he knows how to get attention, especially from the press, correct?
He does. I mean, he's got this kind of sarcastic, sardonic profile that he's been cultivating for years and years on social media and as a political candidate. It's different from most folks. It's very irreverent. And it's something that he's honestly had to do because he's been off the campaign trail since May after having his stroke. And so some of these, you know, Twitter trolling, the stunts like flying a plane over the New Jersey shore to say he's welcoming Dr. Oz home, it's a way for him to kind of show activity and show that he's like campaigning and still part of this, even when he's not himself physically out on the campaign trail. And it's kind of given an impression of activity at a time when Oz has been actually out doing a lot of in-person events across the state, dozens of them. It's kind of kept Fetterman in the mix and in some ways drawn more attention than your traditional campaign stops often do.
And Holly, Oz has been out and about. We know he was down in South Philly getting a cheesesteak, which is what people generally outsiders do in Pennsylvania or here in Philadelphia. But how does he respond to this carpetbagger charge?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good opportunity to kind of spell out, like, you know, Oz's residency here, which is important. So he, until recently, lived in New Jersey for decades. But he does have some roots in Pennsylvania. You know, he went to school in Philadelphia. He got married in the Philadelphia area. His in-laws are here, and he moved back. So he's not living in New Jersey right now. And yes, you do have to live in the state that you represent at the time of the election for the Senate. So the residency requirements are a little looser than they are for some other positions. So he's not actually living in New Jersey right now. I feel like some people who might be following this election not super closely may not realize that. It's important to say. And, you know, I mean, right now what he's doing in response to Fetterman, particularly online, is kind of trying to troll him right back. You know, they've started doing this thing called the basement tracker. This is sort of a reference to, you know, criticisms of Joe Biden's campaign back in 2020, you know, that was cloistered and, you know, he didn't get out much because of the COVID pandemic. And so, you know, people would say that he was in the basement. They've, you know, taken that and said now Fetterman's in the basement. It's his, you know, 70th day in the basement or whatever. So they've started trying to kind of troll him right back. And I think, you know, what's interesting, particularly about the carpetbagger trolling, is, you know, how is it going to play in Pennsylvania, which is like a famously parochial state? I just think it's kind of an interesting test. You know, yes, the same attacks were launched against Clinton in New York. But, I don't know if New York is known as just being quite as parochial as Pennsylvania. And there was a poll recently that came out by Fox that showed Oz down by 11 percentage points, and a larger number of people said that they were concerned that he wasn't familiar enough with the state to be an effective senator. As there were more people that said that than said that they were worried that Fetterman was not in good enough health to be a senator. And so it is having an impact. And it's important to note, too, that Fetterman's TV ads are making the same argument. So it's not just online. But at the same time, I think primarily what's driving Oz's problems in the polls right now are actually his difficulties with Republican voters. It was a really brutal primary that he had to get through. There were millions of dollars of negative ads that were spent against him. And so he has a real issue right now with really coalescing the Republican base. And so that's right now, I think, what his problem is primarily. Mm-hmm. And that's why he's down. And so if that changes and, you know, Republicans say that all those people are going to come back home, then the race is going to tighten. Democrats think it will tighten. And then the question is, do these carpetbagger attacks, you know, land?
Well, and I wonder, Stephen Medvick, if there's a sort of a limit to how often you can tweet about someone being from out of state, and then it sort of loses its comedic charm, if we can put it that way.
Right. And it may at some point start to backfire even. You know, people may say, okay, that was clever and kind of cute, but now we want something maybe more substantive. I think Holly's point about you know, Oz really needing to kind of shore up the Republican base after the primaries is a really important one, because he sort of got hit from both sides. You know, the a lot of MAGA voters, Trump supporters were suspicious of him. And so they had an alternative in Kathy Barnett. And you remember that there was a little bit of controversy. You know, some of those voters were kind of questioning the former president and saying, why did you pick this guy who doesn't really seem to have good MAGA credentials? But then he also got hit from the other side, more mainstream traditional Republicans. So the very first goal after the primary should have been to shore up that base, to mend fences. And I'm not sure he's gone very far in doing that to this point.
Jonathan, let me talk to you about a story that you had recently in the Philadelphia Inquirer about John Fetterman. And this is, I guess, a claim by Oz and the Republicans that he's essentially, you know, pretending to be blue collar with his appearance and his politics. As you write, he grew up in a middle class family, went to graduate school. He has some of the credentials of being a sort of solidly middle class or even upper middle class person. What is the argument that the Republicans in Oz are trying to lay at John Fetterman's feet?
So Fetterman has this image of, because he's the mayor of Braddock, which is, you know, a steel town that was, you know, very much affected by the economic changes as much of southwestern Pennsylvania was, just outside Pittsburgh. And he's got this image, this unusual image with his tattoos, his goatee. You know, he comes from a rough town, that he's this very blue collar guy who's extremely different from your typical politician. And in some ways he is different, or in a lot of ways he is different. But he has also openly acknowledged throughout his public life that, you know, he grew up in a very comfortable family. His parents were successful. His father ran a very successful insurance business. He went and got an MBA himself, was on path to kind of follow that track. And his family, to the point where even his family was able to support him while he was working as mayor, earning very little money in that job, giving him, as far as we know, tens of thousands of dollars a year to support him deep into his adulthood. And so Republicans are saying, look, he is not the person that you say he is. And, you know, one of the big selling points of John Fetterman to his supporters is, well, he's like an authentic, regular guy. He's not like a slick politician. And part of this attack is Republicans trying to say, no, actually he is. He's kind of putting on an act just the way other politicians do, and he's not this person that he seems. So that is something that I think they're going to try to emphasize. It remains to be seen, I think, how effective that will be given how long Fetterman has been on the scene, how deep set this image of him is, and some of the questions around Oz's authenticity, which kind of go back to those residency questions, if he can really kind of land that punch on someone like Fetterman.
Holly, do you think, I mean, Fetterman's been in the public eye and has been, you know, a very outspoken promoter of Bernie Sanders and other people that have run for elective office. Are his blue collar credentials, are they legit?
I mean, look, Jonathan did a great job of spelling out, you know, what his background actually is. He's not blue collar. You know, he doesn't have work in that field. I think that's fair to say. His whole currency is basically being seen as authentic, right? And Republicans are trying to come in and say he's a fraud. And if they're able to land that, like, that could really, really hurt him. But as Jonathan pointed out, the question is whether or not they actually can do that when they have kind of a flawed messenger in Oz because of the residency question. And then because Fetterman is just so well known and well liked in Pennsylvania, right? He won overwhelmingly in the primary. He's built up this brand. He's been very active in media, you know, national media and local media. And so, you know, in a lot of minds of the voters, his brand is already established and he's already liked. And, you know, it's hard, I think, sometimes to disrupt that. But, I mean, this is what Republicans are going to try to do. And, you know, I thought it was interesting. Oz's first ad was a negative ad about Fetterman rather than a positive ad, which suggested to me, at least for now, they're trying to drag down Fetterman's favorability numbers as opposed to trying to rehabilitate Oz after this rough primary. You know, they may feel as though that's the only kind of shot that they have is, you know, getting in the mud and dragging him down because Oz's numbers are just, you know, not great.
We're going to send We're up on a break, and I don't want to interrupt you mid-sentence. We are talking about Pennsylvania politics today on Radio Times. Some really fascinating races and certainly key issues at stake. Talking with Holly Otterbein, national political reporter at Politico. Jonathan Tamari, national political reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Stephen Medvick, director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs, also co-director of the Floyd Institute for Public Policy and Professor of Government at Franklin and Marshall College. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stephen, I'll talk to you after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with our guests about the fact that the political season in Pennsylvania is heating up. A number of races are getting national attention. We're getting you up to speed on the race for the governorship and also for the U.S. Senate, talking a bit about the candidates, the issues, and certainly more. Stephen, you wanted to say something, and I had to jump in and shut you down. Go ahead. We were talking about John Fetterman.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that Holly mentioned, you know, the negative ads that Oz is running against Fetterman, and the ad they ran this week, it wasn't questioning his authenticity as, you know, as a working class hero. It was really going after him for being, you know, too far left, and so there was an image of AOC. You know, they made the claim that he wants to eliminate life sentences for murderers,
he does not want to. Do that.
Right, exactly. And in fact, he's asking television stations to take down the ad because he says, you know, that's a lie about his position. But at any rate, I would be surprised. I think if the Republicans and in the Oz campaign try to make too much of the you know, he's not who he says he is, because as Holly suggests, I mean, it's once an image is sort of set, it's very hard to shake it loose. And so they would have to spend a lot of time really trying to chip away at that image. So they may mention that here and there. You know, I'm sure it'll be a talking point. But my guess is that they're their strategy is really to go after him as being too far left.
Let me toss out another issue. This is from Randall. He says, can you comment on Mehmet Oz's dual citizenship with Turkey? Stephen, is that going to be an issue, do you think?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could imagine what Republicans would do with it if the Democrat had the dual citizenship and had recently voted in a Turkish election. But, you know, partisanship is a pretty strong drug, and so people are willing to kind of overlook all kinds of things. Don't know that it really comes down to whether the average swing mm-hmm. voter will care about that. And I suspect some of them will, but I don't think the Fetterman campaign is going to make much of it.
Jonathan, here's a tweet from Simeon, Democrats spent twice as much money getting Mastriano the nomination than his own campaign did. I'm not sure it was that is exactly true about the money, but nonetheless, there is this effort coming from Democrats or the Democratic Party in this state and perhaps in others as well, of funding what they consider to be very extreme candidates on the Republican side, hoping that they win and then thinking that meaning the Democrats, can win in the general election. What's behind this strategy?
Well, so the idea is that if Democrats can help more extreme Republicans win their nomination, And what they do is they run what seems like an attack ad, but it calls somebody too conservative and too close to Trump, which the idea is that once Republican voters see that, that looks like a positive to them and maybe makes them more likely to support that person in the primary. That if those people get the nomination, then they're easier to beat because they're seen as outside the mainstream. The issue here, from even a Democratic perspective, is that if you're saying these people are a threat to democracy, and that's what the Democrats believe about Doug Mastriano, you're also helping him get basically within one step of the governor's office, within, you know, a freak event a week before the election that swings things, or just honestly, natural political gravity in a midterm election when usually the president's party does pretty poorly. So there's a question of, if this person is really that dangerous, why would you elevate them? Democrats would say, well, they were all going to be extreme anyway. There was not like a moderate option in the Republican primary in Pennsylvania. But we've seen in other states, even when there has been a moderate option, Democrats have still stuck with this strategy. They think ultimately it'll help them win, but if not, there could be severe consequences for it.
And I would think some donors to the Democratic Party would object to their money essentially supporting, you know, a candidate that they would view as very extreme.
I haven't seen that yet, but I would imagine that there could certainly be some folks who did not think that's what their money was going to.
Here's a comment from Chris, and Holly, I'll put it to you, who says Dr. Oz didn't buy any cheesesteak. He went to Geno's, which has a lot of racist incidents in its history. A sign that said, "This is America," when ordering, "Please speak English." It got removed in 2016, but nonetheless, apparently the voicemails used to say, "Press 1 for English, press 2 for deportation." I think this was strategic. It's a stealthy way of appealing to racism in Pennsylvania. Was that a risky move, Holly, on his part?
I mean, you know, going to Pat's and Geno's is like, it's something that tourists do, yes. It's also often something that politicians do. We've seen many Republicans and Democrats go there, so I don't know if I would call it a risky move politically.
Let me ask you, and I've noticed this is not recent, but over the last couple of election cycles, Holly, is that when you see yard signs for candidates, you never see their party. You don't see if they're a Republican or a Democrat or independent. It's the rare sign that seems to associate a name with a party. Does that tell us something?
That's an interesting question. I mean, in a place like Pennsylvania, you know, in a very swingy state, you need to win over independents. And so, you know, it makes sense that I guess you might not want to put that on your yard sign, but I wouldn't read maybe too much into that. I mean, after all of the advertising in an election, like, everyone knows who the Democrat is and who the Republican is.
Stephen, what do you make of that, if anything?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting point. And it does suggest that there's some kind of kind of gut level sense that you don't want to be overtly partisan. And I think that goes to the issue of trying to appeal to swing voters. As I said before, you know, the base, the partisan voters know who their nominees are. You don't need to remind them of that. But, you know, in a general election, the signs that are in yards are probably trying to get some name recognition among those that don't follow politics very closely. So to add a partisan label might be seen as counterproductive. But like Holly says, I think most people who are intending to vote probably know which party is which.
And Jonathan, we tend to talk about Pennsylvania as a battleground state. I don't know if that's still true, but I'd just be curious about what the party registration is, you know, at this time. Do you know?
It's still slightly more Democratic than Republican, but it is absolutely a battleground state. And in many people's eyes, it's maybe the premier battleground state in all of America. I think party registration tells us less than we might think, because there are still people who are Democratic who vote more Republican. There are Republicans who now vote more Democratic. There's been this big realignment that's been taking place for some time and was really accelerated in the Trump years. I mean, the fact is, you could just look at our last two presidential elections that were decided by in the ballpark of 1% of the vote. It is absolutely a battleground state and is possibly the most important battleground state in the country.
Let me toss this to you, Stephen, but I want to hear from the other, you, Jonathan, and Holly. As we know, President Biden's poll numbers are really low, I think, in the 30s, or they certainly have been in the 30s. You know, he claims Pennsylvania is where he grew up, but grew up in Scranton. Is he a liability, do you think, for the Democrats running in the states even?
Yeah, well, look, in a midterm election year, the president is almost always a liability. I mean, there's just a sort of a cyclical nature to the way people view the president and the job that he's doing. And so, you know, he wins re-election and then he faces a lot of difficult choices or difficult decisions. And that starts to erode the president's approval rating. That usually, you know, hits a low point around the midterm election. And then if they run for re-election, the campaign for re-election begins to increase their standing toward the end of their first, you know, the end of their term. So in general, presidents are a drag on their party in midterm elections. You know, you could differentiate, though, those presidents who have pretty bad approval ratings and those that have really bad approval ratings. So it is the case that the president right now, his standing is pretty low by historic standards. And that should normally suggest, although I don't know that it necessarily will, normally suggests a really bad year for Democrats.
And Jonathan, we've been focusing on, you know, the two sort of marquee races, but I wonder whether the president's standing will reverberate in some of the lower races.
Almost certainly. I think that politics has just become very nationalized over the years. We saw that. I think one really strong example was after President Trump won in 2016. You saw in 2017 these really local races that had nothing to do with federal politics. You know, Democrats won all these seats in county, you know, county offices, prefonitary and things like that. That had nothing at all to do with national politics, but Democrats just wanted to vote against any Republican they could. I think that a lot of voters now go into the voting booth these days thinking about the president, thinking about what's happening in Washington, and a lot of votes just flow from that.
How about you, Holly?
Yeah, it's a huge drag, and I mean, I think it is even more likely to be a drag on Democrats, you know, who are running for U.S. House seats as well as state legislative seats, because in the big marquee races for Senate and governor, you have enough advertising money, you have enough media attention that if you, you know, are running a good enough campaign, you can define yourself as different. Whereas, you know, when you're running for things that get less attention, it's much, much harder to do. And so, you know, I think that's going to absolutely be a drag on Democrats, really everywhere, but especially in those lower level races.
And Holly, how much money is flowing into these coffers?
For Senate and governor?
Yeah.
So the big fundraisers have been the Democrats so far, actually, for Senate and governor. Interestingly, both Fetterman and Shapiro have outraised their opponents. Mastriano in particular has had a lot of trouble fundraising, you know, I think because he is so anti-establishment, because he is so new on the scene of politics. You know, he was a colonel for many years, so he is brand new, and he doesn't have those connections, he doesn't have those ties to the establishment, although it's warming to him. You know, he's not a creature of it, and so he's had a real issue fundraising, and to the point where he doesn't even have TV ads up right now. Oz has struggled a little bit with fundraising. He was a self-funder during the primary, and then afterwards just hasn't been able to raise as much money as Fetterman. I expect him to have not nearly as much trouble as Mastriano, you know, and he hasn't as of yet even. He still does have the ability to self-fund, although he, you know, gave a little bit less money, I think, than many Republicans hoped he would in this last cycle. He, you know, he could give himself more. And, you know, the Senate is on the line. It's a 50-50 Senate. So, you know, the NRSC right now, for instance, is you know, helping him fund an ad. So I don't anticipate as much trouble. But it has been a, you know, edge that the Democrats have, that they've been able to, you know, raise more money so far.
Stephen, do ads work? Do they get people elected?
Yeah, they can. When people don't have a lot of information about candidates, you know, for example, Mastriano, at least in our latest poll back in May at FNM, Mastriano was largely unknown. And so the fact that Shapiro is on the airwaves so heavily now this summer, kind of defining him as a candidate, is likely to have an impact. If I could just say one quick thing,
sure,
about Jonathan's point about nationalization, and this is not a shameless plug, but my colleagues and I have a book coming out later this year about nationalization in the 2020 Pennsylvania elections. And what you actually see is that it is absolutely true that voters are voting up and down the ballot for a party. But we found lots of cases where, and Brian Fitzpatrick's an example of this in the first congressional district, where a presidential candidate may have won a district, but candidates down ballot were able to buck that trend and you know, and get voters to split their tickets. So the point is, candidates matter. And I think part of what the Republicans are struggling with in a number of Senate races, including Pennsylvania, is that some of their candidates may not have been some of their nominees may not have been the best candidate to put forward in the fall.
Almost out of time, but let me put this to you, Jonathan Tamari. And this is something actually that Holly Otterbein was told this morning in Politico, that John Fetterman is going to get back on the campaign trail, has an event next Friday in Erie. It's been a couple of months since his stroke. Have you been able to talk to him or talk to his people about the status of his health?
I have not personally been able to talk to them. And first of all, full credit to Holly for breaking that news.
Sorry,
this morning.
Holly. I know.
I have not. You know, Fetterman has not done any interviews except for one since his stroke in May. He did one with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He said at that time he was getting close to 100%, but nobody has really seen him out. At least not reporters have not seen him out at a full public event taking questions. You know, he's done fundraisers, but those are behind closed doors, and it's, you know, with a controlled group of people who are supportive of him by definition. So this will be our first chance to kind of just see how he seems, you know, and how he handles off-the-cuff questions, presumably, if he is going to be talking to reporters at that time. So it's about 3 months from his stroke. It's about 3 months until Election Day. And I think it's a major question of, what does he seem like on the trail? And then how often is he able to be on the trail after this first event?
And we should say Holly Otterbein did break that story this morning and joined us today on Radio Times. Holly, thanks so much for being part of our conversation.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. National political reporter at Politico. Jonathan Tamari, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. National political reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Stephen Medvick, thank you for joining us on the show, talking about PA politics.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs, co-director of the Floyd Institute for Public Policy, professor of government at Franklin and Marshall College. To replay this hour and any other hours of Radio Times, and we have a lot of them, you can go to WHYY.org. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.